agree Saddam is a nasty piece of work, and we agree that we can't allow Saddam Hussein to play politics. It's a question of how you go about that.
There's a picture floating around of the president looking through binoculars, and he's got the lens cap on.
We have been going all around the world, kidnapping, basically, citizens from Georgia to who knows where, to Afghanistan, and bring them back to Guantanamo Bay, to Camp X-Ray.
The President of the United States says Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq represents a threat to international peace and security. And yet, if you go back to the weapons inspections records themselves, what you'll find is as of 1998, Iraq had been fundamentally disarmed.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, November 26, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. International arms inspectors, fully conscious of their responsibility, are ready to fan out over Iraq with the latest detection gear in search of mobile labs, underground factories, or other signs the Iraqis may be hiding weapons of mass destruction. 18 UN inspectors arrived in Baghdad today. The first inspection is planned for tomorrow. Iraqi officials told UN inspectors that they have no weapons of mass destruction and expressed reservations about inspections of President Saddam Hussein palaces. Head UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix briefed the UN Security Council on their plans for inspections.
Well, good afternoon. I have been briefing the Security Council about our visit, Mr. El-Baradei's, and my visit to Baghdad and the team that we brought and the discussions that we had with the Iraqis and also with the preparations that are made for inspections. As you will have seen, the essential physical infrastructure is now in place to start inspections, and the first team of inspectors, 11 from the IEA and 8 from the IEA and 11 from UNMOVIC, have arrived today in Baghdad, and we expect the first inspection to take place on Wednesday. The talks we had with the Iraqi government were in large measure a follow-up on the discussions we had with the same people in Vienna on practical arrangements. We settled a great many of these arrangements in Vienna, which was desirable and necessary after a period of 4 years without inspectors. And I think we were pleased that that was done. In Baghdad, we settled a few more. So now the plane, the ferrying our people from Larnaca, where we have a field office and we have an agreement with the government of Cyprus, and they're ferrying the over to Baghdad. We have opened the office that UNSCOM and the IEA had there, and it's being cleaned up, and there's a lot of new equipment coming in, computers and secure telephones, and we are loading up with a lot of cameras and tags and whatnot that will be placed in the field. In the discussions with our Iraqi colleagues, there was some talk about the declaration that will be provided by Iraq to the Security Council by the 8th of December. And they expressed some concern about what the actual council wanted, because this was a new format. It was not stated that it should be the same type of declarations as the full, final and complete declarations, which they were familiar with in the past. And Mr. Baradei and I said that we were not authorized to give any interpretation of what the council had demanded. But clearly the most important part of it was that which related to a demand for anything concerning the weapons of mass destruction program. They maintain the position that they have had all the way until now, that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And we simply said that I said that they think they should look into all their stores and the stock. And stocks, and that this was a fundamental part of the declaration. We are going in good faith and on the instruction of the council, and the Iraqis are saying to us that they want to cooperate. Some member of the council said that so far so good, and I think that's true, but while the council has had a difficult time, we have been in the easy phase, and we do not have any illusions that it's an easy job laid upon us. The council gives us a lot of authority, and we have to interpret that. And we are certainly going to be faithful to the instructions of the whole council. We get recommendations and advice from all countries, including the United States. But I'd like to say that we may not be the brightest in the world, but I can tell you we are in nobody's pocket. We are keeping open the possibility of having offices in several places in Iraq. But we chose Mosul first. We have more sites to inspect in the region of Mosul than in any other region apart from Baghdad. We may return to the question of Basra or other places indeed for that matter. The Iraqi response was a positive one. We will be going up there very soon and see at some place which they may help to put at our disposal. I said to the council that any indications of where we might be going or what types of places we'll go to are speculations, and that we are not going to tell. The council authorizes us to go anywhere, anytime, and we intend to do so. We will inspect all sites on an equal basis, as the Security Council has said very explicitly. The Iraqis said they are intent to cooperate in all respects under the resolution. They did remark, however, that ministerial buildings and ministries and presidential sites are not the same thing as factories, and that is undeniable. I think I said in Baghdad that the production of mustard gas is not exactly the same as production of marmalade. You do expect those who produce chemical weapons to keep some tracks of what you have produced. That is in their own interest, and I'm sure they do. And they have provided a lot of figures to UNSCOM in the past. These figures do not give a full account, and if they want to be believed, they had better provide either the weapons if they remain or better accounts. They have the budgets, they have the archives, they have the reports of individuals. We do not. And if they want to be believed, they better come up with this. I had said here, as you probably know, that with the country having a petrochemical industry, to declare all the programs they may have in chemistry might be difficult within 30 days. I think they took the examples that if you have a production of slippers by plastic, well, is that so significant? So I think they are concerned about how can they put together all the reports within the 30 days, but they did not really suggest that they would like to have any delay or any postponement. I have the feeling that they're going to try to put up a very substantial report.
Head UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix. A National Security Council task force is recommending an action plan to President Bush that is designed to force Saudi Arabia to crack down on terrorist financiers within 90 days or face unilateral U.S. action to bring the suspects to justice. According to two senior U.S. officials cited in today's Washington Post, the interagency plan was devised before the recent furor over allegations of Saudi involvement in terror financing, and it comes amid growing concern among some congressional leaders and U.S. allies that the administration has been unwilling to press Saudi Arabia for action for fear of alienating a key Arab ally as possible war with Iraq looms. Jonathan Reingold is a former research associate at the World Policy Institute.
What I really think is that the Bush administration has been downplaying all the Saudi connections so far. They keep saying that we're not going to speculate if there's anything. We're going to wait and see what the FBI comes up with, and that all these transactions are difficult to trace. They're all cash, and so we must be patient. But I really believe that they've had this information for quite some time now, and it's only finally coming out.
And what information is it? You've done some research on this topic, obviously. What have you discovered?
Well, there has been several articles in the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post that have detailed basically individuals, singled out individuals, Saudi individuals, private financiers who have been funding Al-Qaeda. In fact, one of them was named in a lawsuit by the World Trade Center victims. And in fact, there was a very recent draft congressional committee report that just came out saying there was a connection, real connection between the Saudi government and funding for Al-Qaeda in the form of possibly Prince Saudi Princess, the wife of the U.S. ambassador, was funneling money to two Saudi men in California who then in turn aided two of the hijackers. And so the list goes on, but it's seeming more and more clear lately that there's a definite connection, and it goes very high, too.
Well, how high would you say?
I'd say to the highest levels, which is why the administration up till now has been so reluctant to do anything about it.
Well, why would the Bush administration be reluctant to pursue this?
Well, it's not in their interest. Right now we're preparing for a war in Iraq, and we don't want to disturb Saudi Arabia at all. If we destabilized Saudi Arabia as we try and go into Iraq, then this may spread into a much wider conflict. We want to keep the oil prices down during a possible war. Plus, if Saddam tries to flee, for instance, we want help in trying to catch him. We don't want anything to get in the way and disturb our plans here.
But there were reports prior to our impending war with Iraq about the fact that there were Saudi oil connections leading to the George Herbert Walker Bush White House.
Right. But again, those were downplayed and nothing was done about them. We have been going all around the world kidnapping basically citizens from Georgia to who knows where, to Afghanistan, and bring them back to Guantanamo Bay, to Camp X-Ray. But we've been doing nothing whatsoever about the people that have been writing the checks, because these are the upper-level people, and we don't want to disturb them at all. We've had this relationship with Saudi Arabia that goes back to 1945, this deal between Franklin Roosevelt and King Abdulaziz Ibn Saud, that basically said the United States would protect Saudi Arabia from foreign threats, and in return, we would gain preferred access to Saudi oil. And now implied in this deal was that the U.S. would overlook the autocratic nature of the Saudi government, as then it was a buffer against communism. But this now is starting to turn against us, as we can see.
Why do you suppose these new reports are surfacing now?
Probably because it's getting so bad and it's so obvious that there are some whistleblowers. Also, there's always been this neoconservative view for some reason that's really against Saudi Arabia in general. I'm not sure where that comes from per se, but they, you know, many people think we should be out of there completely. I don't know if I'm in complete disagreement with that. We have, you know, a huge base. We've built a whole military city over there. And ironically, that's not too out of line with bin Laden's own wishes. They would like to see the U.S. Pull their troops out of the Holy Land.
There are reports today that U.S. officials are urging the Saudis to expose their funding ties to, I guess, to possible al-Qaeda terrorists. Is that something that you had stumbled upon in your research earlier, or is that surprising that there are actually ties to the terrorists, or that there may be ties to the terrorists?
Right. I don't think it's surprising. It's just, I spoke this summer with an upper-level Pentagon official who denied, you know, any connection between the Saudi government and 9/11, for instance. And it was almost such a flat denial that it made me suspicious. Mm-hmm. And then I looked further into it and saw that, okay, there's some pretty obvious connections here.
Like what?
Well, like I mentioned, the one that was named in the Wall Street Journal. And then also you have last month, when was it, October, maybe late September, U.S. intelligence came out with a list of about a dozen of al-Qaeda's Saudi financiers, and then the Treasury Department at that time sent officials over to Europe to start negotiations to gain cooperation in freezing their assets. And apparently these private Saudi citizens have been funding al-Qaeda all along and enjoying the protection of the government. And obviously we've known about that if our intelligence community came up with this list. So that was already up to 2 months ago now. So it's no surprise that you're hearing this in the news now again.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. has said it doesn't want to, it wants to go after any country that harbors or supports terrorists. Is it likely that they'll be going after Saudi Arabia?
No, I doubt it. I mean, obviously, the Bush administration is not willing to sever ties to Saudi Arabia. I cannot see us pulling out our troops even anytime soon, closing our bases, you know, and do you really think the American people are willing to pay $5 or more at the gas pump, for instance? I mean, Saudi Arabia has the largest excess capacity as far as being an oil-producing nation than any other country so far. And so they can afford to undercut anybody in the oil market. They have decisive price control in OPEC as well, and so we need them now. So we're not about to sever our ties.
And the Bush administration, the Bush family is from Texas, and they're in the oil business, and I guess it doesn't require rocket science to figure that one out.
No.
But precisely, did you see a trail, an oil trail there?
Yeah, I don't know too much about that. I remember I did do some research on energy ties that the Bush administration, like the top 100 Bush administration officials had to the energy industries, oil, gas, electric, et cetera. And yeah, there are obvious ties. I mean, there's Dick Cheney, former CEO of Halliburton, you know, they do a lot of oil drilling and stuff, but it's tough to prove a direct one, but enough people have said, okay, obviously there's a connection here.
Jonathan Reingold is a former research associate at the World Policy Institute. An article taking aim at a key figure in the anti-war movement appeared in Sunday's New York Times magazine. It targets former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter and statements he's made regarding Saddam Hussein's possible weapon arsenal. Dr. Rahul Mahajan is author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. We spoke with him about the article and his perspective on it.
I think in large part it was fair to go from questions about Scott Ritter and his own personal motivations to questions about the accuracy of what he's saying about Iraq right now involved a fair amount of a leap. And unfortunately, that's the kind of thing we've been seeing in media coverage of Ritter for some time now.
Do you know Scott Ritter personally, and can you speak to his character?
No, I don't know Ritter personally, and I think really his character is largely irrelevant. Most of what he is saying is corroborated by other independent sources, including in many cases by other UNSCOM weapons inspectors. He's simply putting it together in a more coherent and politically sensible way.
The article calls into question his possible motivations. Is it likely that he has a less obvious, perhaps a self-serving agenda?
I can't speculate on that at all. In general, if you come out in favor of U.S. wars, you get more media coverage, you get more sympathetic media coverage, you get higher speakers' fees, and so on. So if it's just a gross pecuniary motivation, that seems unlikely. Certainly the talking heads of the other side do much better than anti-war speakers.
Some might suggest that perhaps he's comfortable or gravitating towards the glare of the limelight.
Well, when Ritter resigned from UNSCOM, he got a lot of limelight very quickly. In fact, even more than he's getting these days. And at the time, it was with aggressive statements of how UNSCOM was not fully doing its job, something which some members of the establishment here picked up on as being justifications for taking a stronger stance against Iraq. So had it just been about limelight, he could have simply continued in that manner.
Mm-hmm. Well, some read the article and they're left wondering if he might not be exaggerating the truth to sort of further his own personal ends.
Well, there's a number, for example, that he uses. He says 90% to 95% of Iraq's stocks for weapons of mass destruction were destroyed by the inspections process, which stretched from 1991 through the end of 1998. Now, this is not his own number. In fact, a common number UNSCOM is using was 95%, and if anything, he's shading it a little bit to make sure he doesn't overstate it. There is a lot of analysis put out, especially by some experts on the subject in England, about the fact that essentially, even if Iraq had substantial weapon stocks that were not found by the inspections, virtually all of them, with very few exceptions, would be degraded or useless now. This is not simply Ritter's claim. It's something that is backed up by the scientific evidence.
Mm-hmm. According to that article in the New York Times on Sunday, he reversed his opinion on whether Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction or not. That's a pretty key point in the discussion to be making an about face on. Did that cause any concern on your part?
I don't think there's a complete reversal. First of all, we have to understand that the use of the term weapons of mass destruction is a little bit misleading. No one has made any credible claim that Iraq is close to a nuclear weapon. Nobody has made any claim that any weaponized biological agents could actually be effective. It takes a lot more than simply putting biological agents on a ballistic missile warhead in order to make them an effective target. At that time and at this time, Ritter maintains a similar claim that it's quite possible Iraq has some small number of chemical weapons of extremely limited utility in any military circumstances. There's not a huge change there. What there's really a change on is the way he's presenting that information and what political ends he seems to be serving with it.
And what political ends do you think he's serving with it?
Well, I think what has happened is that It started when he was in Iraq, and if he writes in his book Endgame about the way he was truly moved by the suffering of the Iraqi people. Once he got some distance and started to think about it, I think it was doing what he could to alleviate that suffering that motivated him and that still motivates him. And I think another point that's motivating him very clearly now, as he says, is the idea of upholding some larger notion of international law, not an international law that the United States can manipulate, can ignore when it wants, can violate when it wants, and uses only to justify its own particular aggressive plans. He's working for some notion of international law, which holds the United States subject to standards just like other countries, and in particular, in the case of Iraq, serves the UN mandate of disarmament and not the United States' goals of a war for regime change.
I think one would also have to question the motivation of the New York Times for doing an article of this nature at this particular time on someone who's clearly an effective spokesman for the anti-war movement. Has the Times expressed an editorial position on this impending war, to your knowledge?
Well, the Times has gone back and forth. In August, when it seemed as if Bush was going to simply unilaterally declare war and make no justification except his preemption doctrine, the Times went on record saying that not that they were against the war, but that Bush hadn't made the case for the war. More recently, with the sort of UN smokescreen that the Bush administration has constructed through a variety of means, including open coercion in the case of countries like Mauritius, including a lot of behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing and talk about post-war oil concessions to get France and Russia in line. This facade has sort of gotten the New York Times and much of elite opinion to go along and say that Bush is doing the right thing, and even to go along with his pretense that he has not decided yet on whether we're going to war and that war is somehow up to Iraq now, whereas, even a cursory look at what's going on the ground with the U.S. military buildup, with the U.S. preparations for war, shows that the plans are, in fact, moving forward.
Dr. Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. Well, of course, a new round of weapons inspections began tomorrow in Iraq, and Ritter, who's a former UN weapons inspector, believes the Bush administration will use the inspections as a pretext for war. He spoke recently at the University of Maryland about the last round of inspections, what he believes to be the goals of the Bush administration's foreign policy in Iraq and other matters.
The President of the United States says Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq represents a threat to international peace and security, and yet, if you go back to the weapons inspections records themselves, what you'll find is as of 1998, Iraq had been fundamentally disarmed. 90-95% of Iraq's programs had been accounted for by the weapons inspectors by 1996, and this includes 100% of the factories used by Iraq to produce weapons of mass destruction, together with their associated production equipment. And the vast majority of the product produced by these factories has likewise been accounted for. Now, there is things that are unaccounted for, and it is of great concern. But notice when I say unaccounted for, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that we have evidence that Iraq retains this. We simply can't account for it. We don't know what the final disposition of this material is. This is why it's imperative we get weapons inspectors back to Iraq to complete the task of disarming Iraq. And once that's done, to lift the economic sanctions against the Iraqi people and allow Iraq to come back into the fold of the international community, even if that means Saddam Hussein is still at the helm. Of course, when our policy is regime removal, this makes it virtually impossible to do. Do you know that the president has a policy called the National Security Strategy Policy? It's the Bush Doctrine. It speaks of the United States using its overwhelming military and economic superiority to impose a unilateral American solution on problems that have been defined unilaterally by the United States. It says that we will not accept any nation developing economic or military parity with the United States, that we insist that the United States alone maintain its superiority over the globe. We speak of rejecting international law and multilateral solutions. We speak of the United States defining the world as we see the world in terms of failed nations, failed regions, failed non-nation entities. And once we identify something as a failure, we empower ourselves to preemptively strike. American unilateralism, There's another term for it called imperialism. If you think going to war against Iraq is going to teach the world to love us, think again. This is going to be a war the likes of which we haven't seen in some time. I ask everybody here to just go and back to 1993 in a little place called Grozny, Chechnya, and take a look at what happened when 2,000 lightly armed Chechen rebels tried to hold on to that city against the Russian army. And the Russians had to go in street by street, block by block, basically destroy the city to take the city. Thousands of Russians were killed in that fighting. Tens of thousands of Chechen civilians were killed. That's what's coming up against Iraq. Baghdad is a city of 5 million people the size of Detroit. It's defended by 30 to 40,000 fanatics who are loyal to Saddam Hussein, who will not surrender. If we're going to take Baghdad, we're going to have to carve them out, block by block, street by street, building by building. And we're going to chew up a lot of Americans in doing this. Is this really the war we want? I think not. To go to war against Iraq, conservative estimates, $100 to $200 billion of national treasure will be expended to fight this war. To occupy Iraq for 5 years, which is the minimum amount probably needed to occupy Iraq, some people say up to 15 years, you're looking at $450 billion. That's $550 to $650 billion in national treasure. Where's that money coming from? What programs are we going to terminate here in the United States? Aren't we getting a tax cut too? The only reason to go to war against Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, is if Iraq presented a threat to the United States worthy of war. Now, I'm not going to sit here and give Iraq a clean bill of health. I told you, they cheated against us too long. They hid too much. I don't know what they have. In December, Iraq has to submit a declaration listing the totality of its holdings of weapons of mass destruction. Now, Iraq says it doesn't have any. I don't know whether to believe them or not. I think the best thing to do is send the inspectors in and find out. Ladies and gentlemen, the Bush administration has no intention of allowing the weapons inspectors to do their job in Iraq. The Bush administration has every intention of going to war. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to war. It's going to be a horrible war. Thousands of Americans are going to lose their lives. Tens of thousands of Iraqis are going to lose their lives. We're going to destabilize an entire region that's very critical to our economic security and the economic security of the world. You know, we talk about wanting a diplomatic solution with Iraq. We haven't sent a single diplomat to Baghdad in the past decade. Everything about weapons inspections has been just a farce. We have no intention of allowing sanctions to be lifted. We don't give a damn for international law. We are a dictatorship of one, George W. Bush. We might as well call him King George.
Former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter.